Limon Broadcast Center. This is Take 2. Me, Martinez. The deadline to pass a stimulus package is coming up fast. We'll hear where things stand in Congress to help Americans with some financial relief. Plus, Southern California's ICU bed capacity is down to zero. A local nurse will take a step-by-step on what that means for her hospital and what you need to know in case you need to head to the ER. It's all ahead on Take 2. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take 2. I'm Amy Martinez. Coming up.
We're fighting the good fight, but we really do need the rest of the community to fight with us.
A nurse in the intensive care unit pleads with Angelenos to stay home as available ICU beds in Southern California hit zero. That's ahead. But first today, it's a state of affairs, our weekly look at politics in the Golden State. And with 2020 finally heading to a close soon, there's light at the end of this pandemic tunnel with vaccine distribution underway. But for people hoping to get more financial relief from Congress, the outlook, well, that's still a little foggy. With us today are Zach Corser, co-director of the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College, and John Meyer, Sacramento Bureau Chief for the LA Times. Let's start off, Zach and John, with congressional leaders that are racing right now to the finish line to pass a $900 billion stimulus deal by midnight tonight. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had been in a standoff for months. John, give us some top lines of what's in it so far.
Well, I mean, from my vantage point here in Sacramento and not in Washington, I mean, I can tell you that it seems awfully unsettled. I mean, certainly this issue of how much money assistance that folks will get from the federal government, these discussions of a few hundred dollars or an extension of unemployment benefits. I mean, those are really the key things that people are going to be looking for. And the president's role in this certainly seems unclear. And, you know, there's been some news reporting that suggested that's been less than helpful in some. And I think the bottom line here is that people are looking to see what else they can get out of Washington now before a new administration comes in. And they don't feel like they can wait. And you're hearing frustration on the state level as well, because, I mean, the state is hurting. There are a lot of people unemployed. The unemployment numbers again today confirm that. And Washington seems to be at a standstill, which is frustrating.
And John, you mentioned the president's role reports of being less than helpful. In what way? In that he's not helping or in that he's not doing enough to make this happen?
There are news reports that have quoted sources in the White House that have said that the president was trying to seek a much larger amount of money that you couldn't get consensus for on Capitol Hill. And then again, you know, that this has not been led by the White House. I mean, this is the four leaders of Congress, and it's unclear what role the president or his Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, is playing. And again, the bottom line for anyone is a frustration that the simplest of things, helping Americans who are out of work or struggling for financial resources, that can't get done.
Zach Corser, one thing that looks like it won't be in the package, $160 billion in direct aid to state and local governments. What could that mean for Californians, where many local governments are really facing steep shortfalls?
Yeah, it doesn't look good in a lot of California cities. I mean, to take our two largest cities, San Francisco currently has a projected $653 million deficit. And LA has one of $675 million. And if you look at our counties, 55 of 58 of them are in debt right now. So the local funding picture here in California is not rosy. I don't think it has been for some time. And I think there was a lot of thinking in Sacramento and in city halls across California that we could leverage, you know, the next round of funding to basically plug this hole. But it looks like that's not going to happen this year, you know, and we might have to wait until at least, you know, January 20th or a few days after for the Biden administration to maybe take this issue up again. And, you know, some damage could be done in the interim.
John, you've been reporting on the state's finances. Is the state able at all to help some municipalities whose budgets are stretched?
I think it remains to be seen. The governor puts out a budget in a few weeks, a new state budget for the state. We believe there's a tax windfall of somewhere between $15 billion and $26 billion, depending on whose estimate you use. I think that relief for local governments, as well as assistance for schools in distance learning and trying to open back up, are going to be at the top of the list. But that's a short-term fix, and the state and locals need this assistance from the federal government. And that's one of the most interesting things out of this, is how assistance for state and local governments is pretty much off the table from what we can tell in Washington right now, because Republicans, Mitch McConnell in the Senate and others, have objected to it. And yet that is the thing that provides a lot of these essential public services for these communities.
And also the issue, too, one of the issues with the stimulus deal is to what extent companies could be held liable if their employees contract the coronavirus while they're working, while they're on the job. John, what's the situation with that, and what could that mean for California's workers?
Well, that's certainly been a sticking point for Democrats. They've not been interested in including that, with the criticism that corporations are not the ones that are hurting right now. It's the employees. I mean, it is worth pointing out the state of California has a law in place that has a short-term approach toward COVID-19 infections that might have happened in the workplace, workers' compensation benefits, and time away from work and way to help them. But those are all short-term fixes. The long-term question is still in the ball, is still in the court, I should say, of Washington, and we haven't seen any movement there.
Zach, looking at the national picture for a second on this, Republicans and Democrats are in a race for two Senate seats in Georgia, and Joe Biden is set to move in the White House in less than a month. So how would news of a stimulus deal maybe affect those races in particular, or even influence maybe Biden's first critical months in office?
Well, I can't imagine what it's like to be a Georgia voter right now. I mean, after the seemingly endless and difficult 2020 presidential election, to then have this put on your shoulders, two different races that really are going to mean the future of what the Senate is going to look like. So, I mean, I think if anything, this could actually reduce some pressure on voters. Turnout is really going to be the key in that Georgia race. And if people feel that things are okay because Congress got together and made a deal, maybe that will affect turnout. In fact, it might actually affect Democratic turnout more than Republican, I would tend to think. But who knows? There's just so many different factors going on there. But in terms of what it could mean for Biden, I mean, we've still got time here, although not much. We're working against a deadline to fund the government, in addition to worrying about the pandemic package. But maybe this is an opportunity or a sign or a signal that Republicans in the Senate, you know, win or lose in Georgia, can actually work together with Democrats. I mean, there is a package coming together. There's a tremendous amount of pressure to do it. But I think Biden is going to lean, I think, heavily on his Senate experience and his Senate relationships to try to see if he can forge a legislative agenda in 2021.
You know, speaking of leaders in Congress, Democratic New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez made some waves in a recent podcast interview with the news organization The Intercept. And she said that the slowness of this deal is one reason that it's time for both Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer to go.
Even conservative members of the party who think Nancy Pelosi is far too liberal for them don't necessarily have any viable alternatives, which is why whenever there's a challenge, it kind of collapses. And that is, I think, the result of just many years of power being concentrated in leadership with a lack of, you know, real grooming of a next generation of leadership.
Now, as far as who AOC thinks she would replace them, she said not herself, but a few years ago, Pelosi did say that she would step down as speaker by 2022. So, Zach, what does a power vacuum look like in the Democratic Party without Nancy Pelosi?
Well, I think, you know, the influence of California has been, and the profile politically of California has, of course, been raised by having Nancy Pelosi as speaker. If you look at the House of Representatives, and you look at all the leadership positions that Democrats hold on the Democratic side, you know, you've got four different committee chairs, you've got 24 subcommittee chairs that all hail from California. So it's difficult to underestimate, you know, the power of having the speaker. We, you know, there are, of course, others in California, like Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy from Bakersfield. Should Republicans, you know, who have maybe a decent shot at 2022 retake the House, that might be a way for California to again have some influence. But I think AOC is certainly right to point out that there just aren't many people on deck, so to speak, in the House leadership, or, you know, that are thinking about House leadership. If you think of California, I mean, maybe Adam Schiff, you know, given his chair of House Intelligence and, you know, his national profile during the impeachment. But there's a lot of other Californians that were in the House, like, say, Javier Becerra. Had he stayed, he could be in a position maybe to you know, take a larger role. But, you know, it looks like he's off to the Biden administration. So, you know, it's not going to be within the House, but, you know, California will still be represented in Washington.
One more thing on AOC. She was pushing for but lost out on a seat on the House Energy and Commerce Committee to fellow New Yorker Kathleen Rice. And that vote wasn't even close, 46-13, with Politico reporting that there was a lot of tension in the room. John, this Cold War between moderates and progressives in the Democratic Party has seemingly gone on for a few years. Where does this go? And is this a reason why seemingly Democrats have this image of not being united?
I think it's a brewing tension. We've seen it in California a lot. And so, you know, what we're seeing on the national level feels very familiar to those of us who have watched the politics here. I suspect that, you know, a lot of this is the kind of yelling and screaming before a president comes in. And once President-elect Biden's in office, we're going to see what people really pick. I would point to a couple of issues that I think are going to be key to watch this. One of them is healthcare. The progressive wing of the Democratic Party believes in a Medicare for all, a more universal healthcare system. Moderates have looked for a more pragmatic or blended system. And certainly talking about Javier Becerra, the designate for Health and Human Services Secretary, he supported a Medicare for All idea in the past, though he also was a champion of the Affordable Care Act when he's been Attorney General. And then I think on climate change issues and environment issues, because there is a very strong sense that there is an urgency there that progressives feel, and how much you can move the business industry and a variety of industries forward on that. I think those two things are going to be first and foremost to kind of see where this relationship is. Is this yelling and screaming, or is this really a much more larger divide that can't be bridged?
Zach, what do you think? Yelling or screaming, or a much larger divide, as John says?
Well, it's interesting to me. Yes, and I would say, you know, AOC, I think this is interesting because, you know, she's very powerful in terms of social media, her connection to the national press, how she's become a kind of, you know, spokesperson for talking about the progressive movement. But inside Congress, I think she has a very different profile. I think, you know, she ended up supporting a lot of progressive challengers to people who are going to again be her colleague. Hmm. And I think that has done a lot to hurt her reputation amongst her colleagues. They don't trust her. They don't look to her to be supportive. I think that you can see that in that vote. So I think there's a definite discontinuity between her national profile and how she's seen inside the chamber. And I think that also will mean a lot for what she can accomplish as a House member.
We're talking State of Affairs with Zach Corser, co-director of the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Also, John Meyer, Sacramento Bureau Chief for the LA Times. All right, let's turn to California's response to the coronavirus. So when the stay-at-home orders were issued last spring, it was meant to give our medical facilities a little time to beef up for enduring a surge. But now here we are. Resources stretched thin. ICU bed capacity in LA County, 0%. This one's for both of you. I want to know, do you get a sense that officials themselves have stretched out their own options on how to get hospitals to create more capacity, or how to get residents to take better precautions so that they don't get sick and wind up putting pressure on hospitals? Because it feels like at this point, all they do is plead with us to stay at home. John, now, what do you think of California and the way our leaders have handled this?
I look primarily at Governor Newsom, and I would say, you know, the messaging has been there, but it's not really been well received. And obviously, there have been some inconsistencies. Some people have been frustrated with some of the way the governor has communicated the messaging about doing the right thing. On the actual mechanics of this, the Newsom administration is scrambling right now to find these locations for these surge capacity needs. We've reported about it in the last few days in the newspaper, where they are looking to find these other facilities that you would put non-COVID patients to relieve the burden on the hospitals that need those serious services for COVID patients. They have found some, but staffing remains to be the big thing. I mean, I found the most interesting thing out of our reporting is that because California had done so well in flattening the curve in prior months, that that these temp employees who work around places around the country in these surges are already somewhere else.
Oh, wow.
And so we're having trouble actually getting the people we need. So this is going to be the real challenge over these next days and weeks. And I do think a lot of people are worried about the holidays and what that's going to mean for COVID spread and whether people are, in fact, getting that message to stay apart and stay home.
Yeah, Zach. I mean, we've heard last week and this week, don't travel. Stay home. Cancel holiday plans if you can. But Zach, I just was looking at the news this morning, and the airports. People were just heading to the airports, heading to planes to take off. So it seems like the message is being said, but the message is not being received.
Yeah, the timing is really bad in the sense that, you know, we had always anticipated a surge in the wintertime, but the complicating factors, I think, of just exhaustion at all of the orders about the pandemic to stay at home, you know, the Thanksgiving holiday and the fact that many people did ignore it and drove and visited and congregated. And then we've got the upcoming Christmas holiday. I mean, it's really scary. The numbers are astronomic when you compare it to what was happening in March and April, or even the surge that we saw sort of late in the summer. It's really at a scale that is frightening. And yet we seem to be out of tools to convince the public to stay at home. So I think there's some questioning right now going on in the state, you know, coming from teachers unions and grocery workers basically saying, you know, let's shut the state down again in January. One wonders what compliance would be, and one wonders what the pushback would be from businesses who are also, I think, exhausted and hurting from the pandemic and all these restrictions.
One more thing for us here on State of Affairs, LA Mayor Eric Garcetti, he announced yesterday that he is needed in Los Angeles and declined to take a role in the Biden administration. John Myers wondering, was him leaving even a possibility?
I think it depends on who you talk to. I think that certainly Mayor Garcetti had interest there, and there were people who were looking at him. But the thing I am just struck with on a variety of people who maybe haven't gotten to where they want to be or don't look like they're going to this Biden administration is just how this pandemic era has left so many politicians scrambling to explain things. And that's the lesson in politics. When you're explaining, you're losing. And the explanation process versus the leading process, and Mayor Garcetti found himself in a lot of those thickets lately with what's going on in Los Angeles. And I think at a certain point, the Biden administration doesn't need more of that kind of baggage, even if it's a perceived baggage. And that probably was a liability for him.
Well, Zach, he's going to be here two more years, he says. What's his political future beyond City Hall, you think?
Yeah, I mean, let's not turn out the lights yet on his mayoral career here in Los Angeles. I mean, two things I think are important to remember. One, the LA mayor, it's not like, say, the New York mayor, much less power to do things directly being a mayor there. But that said, you know, housing and homelessness have persisted and worsened during the pandemic in Los Angeles. And I think there have been even wider income inequalities. And I think that's one of the reasons we saw, you know, Black Lives Matter and other groups, you know, protesting vociferously to keep him out. So I think he's got 2 years to prove himself as a leader, to get the council together and to get the city united to do something meaningful on those two issues. I think if he does, he will have a much brighter future and a better legacy.
Zach Corser, John Myers, thank you very much. More Take Two coming up in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. While the arrival of a vaccine has brought many of us hope that things are starting to get better, we're still seeing the number of COVID-19 cases rise all across California. And beds in the intensive care unit, they're all filled up. Availability of ICU beds hit 0% in Southern California yesterday, and health officials say the worst of the surge may still be to come. So to help us understand the pressure hospitals are facing right now, we spoke to Lindsay Burrell, a nurse in the intensive care unit at Providence Little Company of Mary Medical Center in Torrance. And she starts out with a glimpse into how everyone's feeling at her hospital right now.
The feeling around the intensive care is a lot worse than it was from the beginning. And we are tiring out. Many of us are extremely exhausted. And we're fighting the good fight. But we really do need the rest of the community to fight with us.
Can you tell us what you're seeing in terms of patient surge and whether you have enough beds for people?
The surge is definitely occurring and faster than we had ever imagined. We are seeing patients come in through the emergency department one after another until, you know, just the other day, there were 22 people waiting to be admitted to our hospital. In the intensive care, the surge has really affected us. We are a 28-bed ICU, and we have filled, I believe we're now at 33 patients of a 28-bed ICU. We are at capacity and beyond. We are seeing patients much sicker, both non-COVID and COVID, coming into our intensive care, needing to be emergently intubated, and we're running code blues more often than we ever have seen. It's a dire situation.
So Lindsay, you mentioned you're a 28-bed ICU, you're at 33. If more people come in, where do they go? Where do you put them?
We make beds. We do. We make beds as best as we possibly can. We're using resources all around our hospital. We're opening up units that, you know, we're making into a makeshift ICU. But I got to stress that, you know, you can build these ICUs and you can build tents outside to act as emergency departments, but filling them with nurses is another challenge. And like I said, we're exhausted. We're functioning on very little energy right now to try to meet the demands of what's coming in so quickly. And I urge people at this point, you know, you have to play your part. I know that many of us, or many of the people in the community, would call us superheroes, and we appreciate that. However, you know, we're also human beings. And in order for us to really provide excellent care, you know, we need the community to really play their part and not have, you know, family functions and family gatherings and whatnot, so that we can really help you.
Yeah, and you mentioned how, you know, you're a human being, right? And human beings, when they get tired, they make mistakes. I'm not saying you're making a mistake, Lindsay, but you know what? When people get tired to the point where they can barely operate, concentration becomes an issue and things sometimes slip through the cracks.
Absolutely. I mean, I can speak for it. You know, we're looking at two patients in front of us under our care, and oftentimes these patients have, you know, 10, 12, 15 different drips that we're titrating. We have machines that are keeping them alive. We have, you know, devices to help the heart pump, ventilators that need to be worked with. You know, we have charting, we have patient care. It's a lot. It's a lot more than the public sees, you know, that you see on TV shows. One little mistake could be catastrophic. And so we need to be on the ball every minute of the day. And when you have 12 hours with two extremely sick patients, it is difficult. It is very difficult. Now, I'm not saying that we're not up for the challenge. We are. But when you're exhausted, it is a different ballgame.
Do you worry, say, by the end of next year, the vaccine is everywhere, and we can definitely see that we are rounding the curve on this. Do you worry about PTSD for what you've experienced this year and your colleagues as well?
Absolutely. Yes, I speak about PTSD with not just nurses, but all medical staff. That includes doctors, nurses, you know, respiratory therapists. I mean, yes, we are all seeing things that we would have never imagined when we went through schooling. Yes, you know, it's a possibility, but then to live it is a different story. Because I will tell you, there are certain rooms in the intensive care that I walk into and I have immediately a very sick feeling, because I can remember having to turn around and tell the family members over a phone call, I'm sorry, but you know, your 32-year-old, 35-year-old, or 80-year-old brother, sister, mom, or dad has just passed away. It is devastating.
We're talking to Lindsay Burrell. She's a nurse in the intensive care unit at Providence Little Company of Mary Medical Center in Torrance. Lindsay, what's staffing like at your hospital right now? We mentioned the shifts, but do you have enough people on the floor to deal with all the patients?
You know, I got to hand it to Providence that they were really given a very hard challenge. And I've got to say, you know, they're meeting tirelessly behind the scenes to meet the demands of what's coming in. And they're updating us every week on staffing and how they're filling in these gaps with resources within our hospital as well as outside of our hospital. And just recently we had, I think it was upward of 120 travelers that were hired to the Providence system to fill in the gaps in the intensive care, emergency department, et cetera, so that we are not short-staffed.
Oh, good.
And then to get even more creative, you know, they've given it bonus incentives to the existing nurses to come in to work extra shifts to fill in those gaps. So, I mean, I got to say, we really have filled in those gaps and it's helpful. And again, I go back to that team, is that when you go in and pick up extra shifts and help or look at a traveler who's come to help, we are so appreciative because we couldn't get through this without it.
Lindsay, you know, when you see restaurants, people packed in them, you know, as a sort of defiant, you know, statement to all of the restrictions that are going on in California. And then you think about where you work and what's going on there. What do you want people to keep in mind about this pandemic, the coronavirus? What's it doing to hospitals as we head into the holidays? Because this is another going to be another time where people might just say, okay, you know what? We're, you know, the vaccine's on the way. We're almost at the end of this. Let's just go back to normal.
Yep. That's what I fear, actually. But this is my plea to the public as an intensive care nurse who works with patients day in and day out. Please, please start listening. I am asked all the time, as well as any nurses, what can we do to help you? How can we help you in the community? You know, in the beginning, it was people were sending us food and cards and you know, just all the support that we could possibly need. And we're so thankful for that. But here's what I'm asking for everybody now. What you can do as a member of the public is stay home. I know you were tired. Trust me, I know you were tired. To the restaurant owners, I know that you were devastated by the fact that you were trying to figure out how you were going to make ends meet when you don't have any income. Is your restaurant going to stay open? Trust me, I feel for you. We all do. But if we don't start complying, our hospitals are not going to be able to meet the demands of what the public is giving us. We simply cannot. What you can do for us is stay home. What you can do for us is avoid family gatherings, friend gatherings. You know, when I see in the public people crammed into restaurants in a sense of defiance of, oh, well, it's too bad. I'm tired of this COVID. I'm tired of being isolated at home, et cetera. You know, the mental health is getting to me. You know, I get it. I get it. I am a human being too. Trust me. Don't you think, like, I'm exhausted and tired of being stuck inside of a house, you know, having to play mom and then go to work? I'm exhausted too. But we as healthcare providers, we're feeling this, putting on PPE day in and day out. You know, it takes minutes. We're hot. We're tired. We're not drinking water. We're not really even eating normally throughout a normal day. We're exhausted. Please just do your part. Please. This is what is recommended, and we just for a temporary moment in time need to comply.
Lindsay Burrell is a nurse in the intensive care unit at Providence Little Company of Mary Medical Center in Torrance. Lindsay, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate you giving me a voice in public, and please help us. We're begging at this point.
We just heard how local ICU nurses holding up. Now we want to know how you're holding up as this challenging year comes to an end. Because these days, how are you can be a very difficult question to answer. But a few of you have had some feelings to share.
Hi, my name is Lionel Modis. I'm calling from Sun Valley, California. And this whole pandemic shutdown has caused a lot of mental anxiety on me. My mom passed away this year, and I've been feeling really lonely and depressed. It's been really difficult. I do miss my mom a lot, and I wish this COVID-19 never happened.
Hi, my name is Kim. I'm from Altadena, California, And I'm angry at how lightly everyone has been taking this pandemic. I think if everyone had been socially distancing, masking, and not having gatherings with people outside of their household without taking precautions like outdoors, distanced, etc., we'd be through this by now. So people are economically devastated, but, you know, if everyone just bears down, we could get through this.
My name is Matthew McGill. I'm from Fullerton, California. I'm feeling extremely blessed. Luckily, you know, my wife and I are both still employed. She's a teacher and I'm an engineer. We're both working from home safely. We have an infant son, which is a challenge, but, you know, a blessing nonetheless, definitely. And I'm feeling especially blessed because I haven't had any close friends or family members that I've lost due to COVID.
My name is Kathy. I'm a social worker, but I've been lucky enough to transfer most of my work to telehealth, so no direct contact. And frankly, I would rather that the cashier or the baggers at Ralph's or at Trader Joe's or at 7-Eleven, for that matter, get the vaccine before I do. So I am a healthcare worker, but I should not be first.
That was four of our listeners telling us how they're doing right now. We want to keep these weekly check-ins going. So if you want to share how you're doing, please give us a call. Our number is 626-583-5281. Leave your name, where you're from, and then how we can reach you, and we'll try to get your voice on the radio. Again, that number is 626-583-5281. All right, if you've had to file an unemployment claim in the last few months, you've likely had to invoke the patience of Job, a biblical level of perseverance and diligence to make sure that your EDD claim becomes cash, you know, something useful. Coming up, we'll check in on getting your check. That's next one. Take two, continue. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. 9 months. That's how long some Californians have now been waiting for unemployment benefits. This year has tested the limits of our public safety net, especially California's unemployment system. Millions of people in the state applied for benefits in order to pay for rent and food, but many were shut out by an often confusing and really impenetrable bureaucracy. And now 1 million Californians are at risk of being cut off unless Congress acts soon. KPCC's David Wagner joins us now to talk about a record-breaking year for unemployment claims and where we go from here. David, thanks for coming on.
Good to be here, eh?
All right, so remind us of the scale of this problem. How many people have applied for unemployment during this pandemic?
So this problem really peaked in the spring. Remember, it was that first wave of business closures when this pandemic hit. In April, we saw unemployment claims skyrocket. You know, applications were up more than 1,200% that month compared to the previous year. And soon after that, more than 3 million Californians were collecting benefits. And things have cooled off since then, but unemployment claims are still many times higher than what we saw pre-pandemic. The scale of this is just really unprecedented, and we're far from getting back to normal.
Has the state been able to keep up with all that demand?
You know, a lot of people have been left behind, and we'll talk about some of the problems, but millions of Californians did successfully receive benefits. And economists always tell me, you know, those benefits really did help people pay for housing, groceries, other expenses, especially early on in the pandemic, because, you know, remember back then, people were getting that extra $600 per week from the Federal CARES Act. Yeah. So when it did work, the unemployment system did make a huge difference in propping up our economy, in preventing people from going into a financial tailspin. But in many cases, it didn't work. And the stories I heard from people who got shut out were often devastating.
All right, what were some of the biggest problems people face this year?
You know, a lot of the people I heard from just got caught in the backlog. Some still haven't escaped. And to explain that a bit, you know, claims go through the state's Employment Development Department, or EDD for short. EDD typically processes claims automatically, and it's giving people benefits in those cases in about 3 weeks. But many claims get flagged for manual review, which can get you stuck in unemployment limbo for weeks or even months. And we saw a state task force earlier this year put out a report finding that EDD is much more focused on fighting fraud in claims than it is on getting people paid quickly. Daniela Urban with the Center for Workers' Rights in Sacramento told me that some of her clients are still stuck.
I'm still shocked when we receive a caller who's been waiting since March or April to receive their benefits. If both those things go away, eviction protection and unemployment, I can't even imagine what our homelessness crisis is going to look like in a couple of months.
So some people haven't gotten through at all. And even those people who do get through, they've still encountered problems.
And that's the most frustrating part of all of this. Some people still haven't been paid. I mean, so what are some of the most common problems you heard from people?
Well, some of the problems that come up over and over again, one of them is the so-called mixed income problem. This faces a lot of freelancers and people with multiple gigs here in LA. Basically, if you have any amount of wages from W-2 employment in your work history, the unemployment system is only going to use that to calculate your benefits. It's going to totally disregard your freelance income, even if that's the vast majority of your past earnings. So I heard from musicians, photographers, other kinds of independent workers who are often getting less than $100 per week to live on. And on top of that, their low benefit amounts were making them ineligible for some boosted federal payments. Later in the fall, I heard from a lot of people getting cut off by unemployment fraud investigations.
About that, David, there have been widespread reports of people cashing in benefits through someone else's name, even instances where California prisoners allegedly got unemployment checks. So how did that problem affect people?
Yeah, so workers' advocates told me that EDD was often punishing people who were the victims of identity theft before even trying to verify their claims. So what would happen is, you know, someone's name and address would be used to file bogus claims, and then that person would be cut off from their benefits, even if they didn't do anything wrong. Some people really struggled to contact EDD in order to get their benefits flowing again. And overall, I just heard from people in many different situations who found that navigating the system was really confusing, even with the help of legal experts.
And now there's another big problem just around the corner. Two of these federal unemployment programs are set to expire December 26th. What's happening there?
That's right. So the Federal CARES Act, which was passed in the spring, created two new unemployment programs. One of them provides unemployment recipients with a 13-week extension. Another is designed for workers who normally would not be eligible for benefits at all, like freelancers and self-employed workers. Both of those programs are going to abruptly end at the end of this month. And researchers with the California Policy Lab estimate that more than 1 million people in California could be left with nothing in a couple weeks. UCLA's Till Von Wachter says a huge chunk of those losing benefits are right here in LA.
So in Los Angeles County alone, we expect over 320,000 individuals to exhaust their unemployment insurance benefits on December 26th if Congress doesn't act.
But that unemployment cliff can be averted if Congress passes a new relief bill.
So that leads us to exactly what you said, that bill, a bipartisan bill in D.C. that's getting a lot of attention right now. It would extend those programs into April, bring back a $300 weekly federal boost to state benefits. David, what effect would that have on the folks that you're talking about?
It would really be a lifesaver for people who are still struggling to find work in this really tough job market. And those same researchers at the California Policy Lab found that extending these benefits would infuse $30 billion into the state's economy at a crucial time in our fragile recovery. You know, for people like Koreatown resident Reardon Tenney, it could be the difference between affording rent or not. He's an unemployed nonprofit worker currently getting benefits through the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, which is one of the programs scheduled to end this month.
No matter how frugal you are, life in Los Angeles is exorbitantly expensive and it's hard to save. And even with saving, when you remove the federal money, you're screwed, you know?
Tenney told me he's hopeful that Congress will come through. You know, workers' advocates told me the same thing. They're really hopeful for relief in the near future. But Tenney said he doesn't understand why Congress needed to wait this long to figure this out.
Yeah, those talks are very much down to the wire. Even if Congress, though, does extend these programs, won't it take time for states such as California to distribute the benefits?
That is a big concern that I heard from worker advocates. They say EDD might have to update their system. They might have to reprogram things in response to any new legislation, which could lead to a temporary lull in benefits to people who may already be late on rent or getting deeper into debt. Matthew Clark is a staff attorney with the Legal Aid Foundation of Los Angeles, and he helps unemployment recipients with their claims. He told me right now he's advising clients to be patient.
My strong suspicion is that it is already too late to have a seamless continuation of benefits.
So a lot of this depends on what exactly is in the final bill. Advocates say if Congress continues these programs as they currently exist with minimal changes, payments could go out faster. We're just going to have to wait and see.
All right. In the meantime, David, how are people making plans to deal with this possible loss of income? I mean, this is coming right during the holidays, and I got to imagine people are stressed out.
Yeah. The legal aid attorneys I talked to all said they're having really tough calls with their clients right now. Kelly McVeigh with Betsedic said some of her clients during this pandemic are now living out of their cars or they're in homeless shelters.
It sometimes feels like as a lawyer, I almost have to be a social worker. A lot of the referrals we're giving out at this time are for social services because people know that they're going to be facing really hard times.
So lawyers are now referring people to food banks. They're referring them to public assistance programs, housing services. They told me they're trying their best to help folks navigate this unemployment system. It's hard to provide hope when there's still just so much uncertainty.
That's KPCC reporter David Wagner giving us an update on the state's historic unemployment crisis. David, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right, last weekend before Christmas week, and hopefully your shopping is both done online and in-store. Hopefully you don't have to do that anymore because you're going to want to find some room for fun. Yeah, stuff to do while we're stuffed in at home. That's coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
While healthcare workers on the front lines of this pandemic are overwhelmed, other medical professions have their own set of challenges.
The financial strains of dealing with COVID with a dramatic drop in practice volume, patients not wanting to come in.
I'm Kai Rizdal, doctors closing their practices. Next time on Marketplace. Weekdays at 3 on 89.3 KPCC.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and most places you get your podcasts. I'm Ian Martinez. As we close out 2020, we bring you a book that caught our eye earlier this summer. Now think back to 1992 in Los Angeles. The four LAPD officers involved in the arrest and beating of Rodney King have just been acquitted. South LA is in complete disarray and the uprising is just getting underway. Much like today, the racial tensions between Black Americans and police are clear as day and being felt by many. It doesn't seem like a lot has changed, right? But if you live through the 90s in LA, I need not say more. It's really a surreal time that you'll return to if you pick up Christina Hammond Reed's young adult novel, The Black Kids, a book Reed calls a love letter to Los Angeles.
The Black Kids is a coming-of-age story that follows Ashley Bennett, a privileged Black teenager, in the days leading up to and following the acquittal of the officers involved in the Rodney King beatings. So Ashley is in a predominantly white neighborhood in a predominantly white high school, private school, and she's kind of been isolated from the concerns of the larger Black community in Los Angeles to a certain extent because of her privilege and because of the way that her parents have raised her. So the book is really about Ashley's process of self-discovery and self-awakening as she realizes which friendships will and will not serve her as she enters adulthood, as she starts to see her parents as people as opposed to just her parents, and as Ashley really just starts to learn more about what it means to be one of the Black kids. What does it mean to be part of the Black community? What does it mean to be part of Black LA? And she starts to experience some of the beauty of what it means to be Black in the face of intergenerational trauma. When I started to write this book, I wanted to use the past to hold a mirror up to the present. I wanted to look at the parallels, and it felt like the Rodney King beatings were a huge moment in terms of it really being one of the first times that we see a civilian capturing an incident of police brutality on a camcorder and then having that footage broadcast for the country to see. As the Black Lives Matter movement got further underway, as we saw the repeated effects of unequal policing and police brutality and the deaths of brown and Black people at the hands of police and vigilantes, I really wanted to look back at that particular moment and how we dealt with those questions then. And I wanted to really look at the continuum of race riots and riots in our nation's history. I think you hopefully are more empathetic if you understand the origins of some of these deep frustrations and hurts that we're currently reckoning with in 2020. I often say that I don't view this book as a book about a riot. I view it as a book about love, and that's really what it is. It's Ashley starting to love herself and love the people around her and love her community. There is this idea of Black and brown people as other that I think is really part of the narrative in the 90s, and I wanted to dispel that. I wanted to showcase the fact that we've been here from the very beginning and we've always been part of what makes this city special.
That's author Christina Hammonds-Reed talking about her young adult novel set in L.A. in 1992 called The Black Kids. All right, finally, if you feel burnt out from the week or the whole year, actually, we can help you on ways to recharge this weekend.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran and A. Martinez. One more week until Christmas. And while 2020 has been all kinds of naughty, we've got ideas on how you can make one of the last weekends of the year nice.
Yeah, I got a mountain of coal on my front yard, Leo. So, okay, what do you have for us? Because I still want to get my hands dirty, though.
So you can make your own tamales, then. In this year, when more people cooked at home, more than they probably ever expected or wanted, you can try making this traditional holiday dish, too, on your own. Tomorrow afternoon, there's a tamale cooking class hosted on Zoom by Dora and Mama Socorro Herrera of Yuca's Restaurants. You do have to register by 5 today, though, because then they'll send you a Zoom link and the ingredients list ahead of time so you can purchase them. And it's $20 per student.
$20. All right, now, what about something for those who want to forget about the world?
Yeah, so you can leave the Earth behind and look towards space. Tonight at 8 p.m., Santa Monica College hosts a celebration of the night sky for the winter solstice. First at 7, there's going to be an online and interactive presentation to show you constellations and features of the cosmos. Then right afterwards at 8 o'clock, senior lecturer Jim Mahone teaches you everything you need to know about the winter solstice, like where the skies fit in with these pagan rituals and more. That's all online from the comfort of your own home, and it's free.
I love keeping my feet on the ground and reaching for the stars. I do that every day, Leo. All right, finally, what about something for people with cabin fever and that are being respectful and responsible about the virus?
So then what you can also do tonight, you can join a theatrical choose-your-own-adventure. It's performed by the Rogue Artist Ensemble, and they've put together this online show. It's different than what you've normally experienced before in a theater. You get to direct the main character, Mike, as he tries to escape from a holiday-themed storage facility. And along the way, there are puzzles, gifts, etc. And it's part of a three-part series. Part one is going to be released tonight. It's $20 per show, or pay what you can. And the other parts are going to be released through the end of this year. Now, there are still a bunch more events to go to online or safely in person. Find out what you can do this weekend by heading to our site, laist.com. That's laist.com. Plus, you can follow me on Twitter, at Leo Has a Cat.
That's KPCC's Leo Duran. Leo, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, really recommend, if you missed it today, to go listen to that ICU nurse that we had on the show earlier, begging everyone to stay home this week. And just head to wherever you get your podcasts, and there we will be waiting to be heard by you and find that interview. It was really good and really thoughtful. You can find us on Twitter, at Take Two. I'm there as well, at AMartinezLA. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two, back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.